Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast, the sibling podcast to the popular weekly title. I'm this week's host, Jesse Billington, and I'm joined by our features editor, Chris Hope.
Hello.
And our content editor, James Peen. Gents, how are we? And importantly, how are the classics?
I mean, at the end of the day, it's you we want to hear from, so we should probably just start with you, Jesse.
The MG works. A year and 2 days to when it last went pop. It has now got a working engine in it that has sort of got a rough tune on it and will sit there and idle away quite happily. So this is all really courtesy of a friend of mine, Richard Woolmer. Woolmer Race Engineering is just north of me in Bedfordshire, and know Richard through the Midget and Sprite Club. I know he's a dab hand when it comes to setting up midgets and sprites, and basically sort of said, look, I've run into a dead end. Dad and I couldn't get this thing to start for love nor money, regardless of how much fuel we were putting through it, how much time we were putting through it, nothing. And Richard came down last night, got to my workshop about 6:45, and it was 7:50 when the car was sat there idling away on the stands running. He worked some absolute magic, literally just sort of tearing through things that Dad and I just had obviously gotten blind to, having looked at it for so long. So we pulled out
you mentioned a redundant condenser.
Yes, yeah. So I've always been curious as to the level of workmanship that went into this car's restoration prior to my ownership. And every now and then I find signs that suggest that maybe corners were cut, or the workshop that did this had very much a sort of a bodget and let it be attitude, which included wiring in a condenser to the new sort of distributor and point system. So that was really throttling voltage to the distributor, which answers why it always hated starting and always had a bit of a bad draw from the battery. So, but once we'd unplugged that, once we'd get the spark plugs down properly, a couple of squirts of carb cleaner through the carburetors just so we weren't sucking on them dry, and it sprung to life. So with a quick sort of fiddle tune with some screwdrivers and sort of adjusting sort of jets underneath the carbs, it just sat there idling away quite happily. We've got it timed in and it sounds quite happy. It's back to sort of chugging away with quite a nice sort of lumpy cam idle as 1500s have. So the plan is we'll get Revival out of the way because he's got a couple of cars heading down to that. And then I will drag the MG up to his workshop. We'll put it on the rolling road there, get the carburetors probably set up, get the timing properly dialed in. And we use their alignment rig just to make sure the steering rack's square where I had it out to do the timing chain cover. So yeah, it was a great night of about an hour and 15 minutes work all in. And we then went to Cafe de Machine, had some beers and pizza to celebrate. So nice. Perfect.
So we're coming up on the year anniversary of it happening, aren't we?
It went bang on the 7th of September last year, because Revival was a weekend earlier last year.
Right.
So yeah, it went bang on the 7th. And we are now officially a year and 2 days later, it runs happily. So we've got just over 60 pounds of oil pressure in it. It came up to temperature nicely, all the water lines are feeling nice and hot, and there's no leaks from any oil connections, any water connections. It's watertight, oil tight, and very happy. So my thanks go to certainly Richard, and more broadly a testament of it's useful to know people from clubs who know what they're doing.
Well, mate, it's only 4.5 months after the drive it day.
Yeah. I did arbitrarily set myself a new deadline of will I get it running before my birthday, and I think we might finally make that one. I do have a final backup deadline of can I get it running and driving by the Classic Motor Show in November, because it's appearing on the club stand there. So I'll have blown through at least sort of 14 different deadlines, but finally got there. But you're used to receiving my copy in that sort of order anyway, so but yeah, have any of you had anything interesting happen with your classics, or is it just my world that's finally seen some success?
I think it's just you. I mean, last time we spoke, I had a new radiator pack to go in the T5, which I was struggling to remove because of previous bodging, rounding off star justice and what have you. They're all out. I've got that sorted. I've got a new intercooler because my engine was so, so oily. It was like literally 2 centimetres thick with oil. So I've had to scrape all that off, and copious amounts of gunk. And then the Beetle is still realistically a weekend away from being drivable. But as I speak, it's absolutely chucking it down with rain. So I'm set, no garage, and off to the Revival this weekend. So that won't be this weekend coming, hopefully the weekend after.
Yeah, see how we go. And Chris, any progress on your own? Because I know you had plans to take the Mini out for one sort of final autumn blast.
Yeah, so all booked up to go to the Peak District next weekend. We've organised a B&B, a few of our friends in an Airbnb, and we're driving over on Saturday. It was Friday, I think it's Saturday now. Going to do loads of driving on Saturday, stay over Saturday evening, and then head back for home on Sunday. So yeah, hoping to take him some nice parts of the Peak District, the Hope Valley, drive up to the top of Mount Tor. Looking forward to that. It's not really done anything really beyond sort of poodling around town since doing the London to Brighton classic car run. So it'll probably be the last thing that it does before it gets parked up and properly serviced. And then I'll, assuming that I've got a bit of free time over winter, get the engine out and make a start on replacing some of its many perished oil seals. So A-Series are in continent at the best of times, but this one's literally taken the wee-wee. So I need to do something about that. Just try and make it a little bit better at holding onto its oil. So that's what I'm looking to do.
Fair enough. Sounds like a lovely plan. I can't believe you're going off to sort of the Edel sort of valley next weekend. I'm heading there the weekend after heading up to Sheffield, so sort of a succession of classic car weekly riders heading up to that neck of the woods. Whether I take the MG or not has yet to be decided, but the Jimny is still off the road. I don't want to use it because the gearbox does not sound happy. Essentially, the middle era of my generation of Jimny has what's called the R72 gearbox. And essentially the oil seals all around it, a bit like your A-Series engine, have failed, and all of the oil is no longer in that gearbox. So I've had to go around, ask a load of sort of local specialists, figure out who's got the best offer, and find one that will remove, restrip, rebuild, and replace, and return the vehicle to me. So they won't even come out, pick up the car, take it away, do the job, and drive it back. Yeah, that's the next vehicle that's decided to absorb all of my monies. Now the MG has decided it's sort of time to be fixed and working. So, as one door closes, another one opens to a different workshop. I might take the MG up to sort of Sheffield next weekend. We'll wait and see what the plans are. But if the weather's going to be absolutely gash, I'll probably just take the Astra like it is set to be this weekend for the Goodwood Revival. But we'll get to that in due course. Anyway, classics out the way. We'll jump into the news section of this week's issue. And there's some great news ahead of the Classic Motor Show at the NEC this November, James.
I have not prepared for this one, so we have to
jump to that. I can feel it if you want, James.
It's the pride of ownership news.
I took a phone call from show organizer Andrea C last week. She was very excited to give us an exclusive story with regards to this year's Classic Motor Show. It's going to be 10 years since one of the big fixtures of the event, which is the Lancaster Insurance Pride of Ownership competition, is going to be 10 years old. So Andrea has been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to speak to all of the finalists that have appeared in that competition over the years, with the mind to bringing a best of the best competition. So as things stand, I think it's about a dozen, isn't it, James, from the top of my head? But yeah,
15 cars at the moment, and it'd be whittled down to five.
Yeah, so if you go onto the Classic Motor Show website, you can see all of those finalists who are taking part, who have appeared in Pride of Ownership competitions over the year. The voting for that will remain open until the 1st of October. You don't have to be a ticket holder in order to vote for that competition. We're just there. They're just looking for as many views and opinions as possible. When voting closes, they will arrive at a top five. And those five cars will be having a dedicated display at the Classic Motor Show, separate to the ongoing Pride of Ownership competition that will be there. And that will have sort of 20 cars for this year's event. And then on October the 8th, those five cars will be announced. Voting will reopen, and then at the event itself, there will be an award ceremony for the car that has achieved the most votes. So, champion of champions, best of the best. Looking quite forward to sort of seeing that. It's going to be something new for the event, and it sounds like there should be some really quite interesting stories attached to some really fantastic cars.
Looks like it's going to be sort of, I always enjoy looking around the sort of the Libu sort of displays, because there's some brilliant stories that sort of get swept into it. And I think sort of having this celebration of some of the amazing stories that have really sort of featured in that Pride of Ownership sort of stand over the years is going to be fantastic. And seeing what the public thinks is always an interesting one as well, getting a gauge of sort of the stories they've most enjoyed learning about these classic cars.
The other thing for me is I'm just going to look at some of these cars and just go, wasn't it here last year? And it turns out that it was like 2017 or something to after.
What's interesting, though, is if you look at the cars that are eligible to be voted for at the moment, yeah, there's like a 1926 Packard, and, you know, 1972 Triumph Spitfire, but then actually it's quite a modern classic selection. So 83, is that still a modern classic? It still feels modern to me, like Golf GTI. 85 Honda Acty, 1992 Golf Cabriolet, 92 BMW 850 CSI. So it's kind of like the modern classics are starting to really come into their own at the NEC.
Yeah, there's this sort of celebration of the younger classics and also the older classics. That Packard is quite interesting. There's a 56 Austin A35 as well. Adorable little cars. So there's a good range of cars in there as well. And also, I've already seen the Morris Minor Owners Club sort of strongly campaigning for the Morris Minor Million that's going to be on display as well. They're always a fantastic car to see, because, again, it's such an important piece of, like, British heritage. Sort of, like, we just churn
splendid these things out. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So there's a good range of cars there. And I think, again, it's one of those things of it celebrates what the Classic Motor Show has always been good at, is its range and its breadth of something for everyone across the sort of years and the eras. So that will be very exciting to see. Elsewhere in the news section, in fact, on the opposite page, we have our lead story, which is this great turnaround for Mini owners after their UK show was cancelled at short notice.
Not just a UK show, but it was the International Mini Meet 2025 that was set to be held in Essex. And that was cancelled with 3 weeks' notice, which left a lot of people anguish and lots of plans up in the air, especially as the company that was set up to run this has gone into liquidation. And they've announced that there would be no funds available to anybody to get their ticket money back. So obviously a lot of people were angry and distressed about it. There's a lot of traction on this on social media. But the positive, as Jesse said, comes from one of the previous organisers of the IMM, Emma Slocum. She came to the rescue with literally a week's notice and ran her own show from an orchard in her back garden, because she felt like she didn't want to let any of the European visitors who traditionally come over, because she said it, with a show like this, it's seeing the same people year in, year out. So she knew that a lot of these people would be disappointed. So having put a post out on social media, she immediately got people saying, yeah, we'll come. And there was also a group of chaps coming from Hong Kong, spent 50 days on a road trip.
Yeah.
And their plan was to meet at, well, end their journey at the IMM. And in the end, they ended up doing it at her show, which was the MCC, or Mini Cheese and Cider show in Taunton. So, as I say, it was, started out quite a negative story when I was digging into this one, and then it actually became a real positive in the end, because as everyone said, one person won't ruin it for everybody else. And as it seems, you know, when people put their minds to something, they can all come together and create something good.
One of those great stories that sort of shows how resilient the classic community is, and sort of when they band together, the incredible things that can be done. I do like the idea of a mini cheese festival as well. I'm not a huge fan of cider, but I could certainly be coaxed in with the temptation of some interesting minis and some cheese. That'd be a great way to spend an afternoon in my mind. But look, yeah, it had a good turnaround, I think, at the end of it. It's one of those things you sort of start digging into it and go, oh, this is terrible. I can't, this is then you sort of like anticipate sort of being able to sort of get sort of gauge public interaction with it and sort of the negative responses. And then sort of when you get these people that sort of come forward as sort of like a beacon of hope within the community, it's nice to see.
It's going to be a number of years until the International Mini Meeting is going to be due to reappear in the UK again. I think it's something like a decade, isn't it, James?
Yeah, so it's something like that. But it all depends, really, because where the next IMM is voted for is at the previous IMM. So somebody has to pitch having one, and then everybody at the IMM has to then approve it. So the chances of it coming back to the UK, according to certain people, are like they might be a little bit slim at the moment because of how this has gone and how people were justifiably quite angsty about it. Yeah, it's happening in the UK. It happen again.
Is the gist of it, isn't it? Which is, you know, understandably so when the event has been cancelled last minute sort of thing. So, I hope that such a big sort of international meeting doesn't shun the UK, particularly given that, you know, the Britain is responsible for the Mini. Certainly, Emma's efforts are to be applauded, and hopefully just the passing of time and things like that and general goodwill and efforts from the wider UK Mini community when we are abroad at these events will hopefully win back some of the reputation that we've lost.
Yeah, hopefully it'll set it back on track. It'd be good to have it back in due course. But I think it's nice to see the show also cycles through other countries as well, because it also celebrates the love for certain marks and models beyond just sort of what we know in the UK as well. It's nice having that international spin to it. So hopefully it'll all be healed by the time it comes back round.
Next year is set for Poland and then Portugal in 2027. So hopefully after that, as you say, back in the UK.
Well, Chris, perhaps once you've finished your leaky little Mini, you'll be able to at least lug it out to Poland. Or at least if it takes anywhere near as long as my projects do, you might make it to Portugal. We'll wait and see. We'll move on from the lead story. Elsewhere in the news section, we've got some brilliant stories. Obviously, we've got a report from Rustival at the British Motor Museum with some of the brilliant cars that were on display there. And James, you were down at Bewley as well. What was your, we'll quickly touch on that. What was your absolute standout there? Obviously, alongside the 1,000 horsepower Sunbeam startup, which is incredible. What was your big find within the sort of the hordes of buried treasure?
I have to confess, I spent £1 and I bought a Hazard spanner. That was the sum total of my expenditure, because I got there a little bit late because the weather on Sunday was atrocious. I was doing 40 miles an hour on the A303 with the wipers going full chat for about an hour. So by the time I got there, I had a quick nip round the main stands, and then I had to make a beeline for the Sunbeam startup, which there's nowhere I could miss that, which was amazing. Sort of anticlimactic because it fired first turn, you know, right on the button and then just roared into life. You kind of wanted a little bit of drama with it, but there was none of that sort of COD TV drama you get with engine startups. So that was amazing. And just generally the scope and the breadth of everything that you can get at the Auto Jumble. I mean, I didn't know I wanted the world's smallest hovercraft, midget hovercraft, but having seen one there, would quite gladly have put that in the back of the R bath and taken that home. But
different, you know, spin on the Sinclair C5s that you normally see sort of
parked up at the side of sort of stands. Yeah.
Yeah, but a bright yellow midget hovercraft. Who would say no to that?
I mean, if it's going to keep raining like it does at the moment, it'd probably be quite a wise investment, certainly a long-term idea. I need to get down to the Bewley Auto Jumble. It's weirdly an event that I've never done, but I'd probably quite enjoy it, I have a sneaking feeling. And probably spend way too much.
I literally could have spent £1,000 within 3 minutes walking through the door because there was a motorbike I wanted. And then I was like, you know, wandering around. There's something you see all over the place. And it's one of those things where you really have to dig into all the boxes of junk as well, especially if you're like me, you like your metric stuff. So none of that stuff goes down particularly well at Bewley because, you know, it's all Imperial and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, if you're a Volkswagen nerd like myself, you can find a couple of bargains, even though I only spent a quid saying that.
Yeah, it's I'm definitely going to have to put it on the list to try and get to next year. It's always a tricky one because it always sort of falls in that gap between Silverstone Festival. Well, mind you, we don't have Silverstone Festival next year, so I might finally have sort of a clear enough run-up to get to it, where my girlfriend won't be sort of missing me for sort of 3 or 4 weeks on end because I've got events to get to. So, touch wood, 2026 Bewley Auto Jumble, I'll try and get along to it. We'll move on then out of our news page. We'll dive actually in something we don't often touch on, which is the out and about spread, because of course this weekend we've got the Goodwood Revival coming up. And gents, both of you are heading along. There's the preview in this week's issue. What are you most looking forward to getting along to the fake racing this weekend? What's most drawn your eye in?
Go on, James, because I know what you're going to say.
What do you think I'm going to say? Go on, I'm intrigued.
I think you're going to be keen to see the plethora of splitties that are going to be taking to the track for a massive anniversary parade.
I can't deny that. That does have a certain attraction to me, being a Volkswagen person. Nice to see Volkswagen taking centre stage at the Revival, although previous year it was the Beach Buggy, I believe, wasn't it? Was that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe Volkswagen's are finally sort of having their time in the sun at the Revival.
Bit of a nice celebration of sort of air-cooled cool in that sense. Chris, what's jumping out to you ahead of the weekend then? What are you going to be sort of properly seeking out? Is it one of the track actions? Is there a display you're looking for?
I'm going to be straight to the paddock and have a look at some of those cars that are going to be in the Jim Clark parade. I think being at the Silverstone Festival and seeing all of the Formula One cars for the Drivers' Championship timeline, with a car representing each of the drivers who have won the competition over the years. I'm really keen to sort of see what cars are going to be there, celebrating the many, many achievements of Jim Clark. I think the reason for this particular anniversary is it's... is it to do with it's his second since he won his second title? Is it
60 years or something? Since his 1965 campaign, where he won F1, British F2, he won the Tasman Series. I can't remember if he won British Touring Car or Touring Saloons that year as well. I think he did that as well. So it was sort of the year where he had like absolute dominance across so many different sort of branches of motorsport. This is sort of like the peak year of Jim Clark, as it were. He had a couple of other good years. He was off always dabbling in different racing events across the season, but yeah, I think he won British F2, French F2, Tasman F1, and possibly BTCC as well. So there's a lot to really be celebrated. Third,
I mean, I follow Formula One, perhaps not to the same degree that you do, Jesse, but it's the one thing about Jim Clark that always stands out for me is I'd never heard of a Grand Slam in the context of a Grand Prix before. It's someone who takes pole position in qualifying, wins the race itself, and achieves the fastest lap in doing so, and then leads for every single lap. It's not just winning, it's winning in the most comprehensive way possible. And for one in every three Grand Prix that he raced, he won via a Grand Slam, which is just, it's mind-boggling when you think about it. It's not just a case of stars aligning, it has to be more than that. It's certainly not luck, not to do it to the degree that he did it.
A lot of it is put down to his soft touch with the cars, the fact that he never overdrove them. And that was in an era that was defined by reliability, by cars breaking down, by these very fragile, spidery machines. The fact that he sort of understood the limits of what they were capable of and was able to extract 110% of the performance with only sort of 90% of the effort through the car gave him that edge of reliability, and it made him a huge hurdle for other drivers to try and sort of come up against. When you look back at sort of Graham Hill, Phil Hill, other drivers that contested against him in period, he was a huge sort of hurdle to try and get past, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that's sort of celebrated. And I think there's going to be not just cars that he raced, but cars he would have raced against, in much the same way that we have the Stirling Moss Trophy. Because I know there's what's going to be a green flag celebration lap ahead of, I think it's the Richmond and Gordon Trophy. And that's got a variety of cars from that same period that are going to be leading away sort of the race for the opening lap. And it's going to be a spectacle to see, I think, and I'm really looking forward to sort of bunkering down at turn one and getting the sort of full volume rush as they all come barreling towards me. So that's going to be good fun. I've got to say, trying to pick a favourite for me for Revival, I'm looking forward for the Alfa Romeo celebrations. So this is celebrating 100th anniversary of Alfa Romeo's first World Championship manufacturer's win and 50th anniversary celebration of their World Sports Car win back in what would have been the 1970s. So we've got these sort of two great anniversary lines for Alfa Romeo coming together with a whole host of their racing cars that we'll be taking to track, including right the way back to sort of the early eras of Alfa Romeo's back in the 1920s. And I know that one of the cars that will be hopefully doing the parade is the first car that Enzo Ferrari ever won a race in, as when he was a racing driver before he actually set up Ferrari, he was a racer for the Alfa Romeo Works team. And I know that that car has resurfaced, is currently being prepared, and will hopefully be part of the demonstration. So looking forward to having a good poke around that. And again, they won't necessarily all be racing across the weekend, but they'll all be sort of gathered together in one of the paddocks. And it was well worth going and sort of having a look around, having a chat with people and finding out the history, because some of these cars are going to be absolutely fantastic. So yeah, plenty to see when it comes to that, plus all the usual racing famous faces over the road. There's going to be some great displays and the car park, which is a show unto itself. So all the top tips in this week's Out and About, and of course the toppest of all the top tips, bring a raincoat. The forecast doesn't look great, but that could change. We're recording this on Wednesday, it might improve. We'll move from the Revival then to the feature in this week's issue, which looks back at the MOT, which turns 65 this year.
Yes, so 1960 is when the MOT was introduced. It's an interesting one because there's a certain topicality to just the way that classic car enthusiasts view the MOT today, particularly when so many of our cars are now considered to be exempt. Is there a need for us to have our cars MOT'd? Can we assess roadworthiness on our own, and is it okay to go to specialists rather than dedicated MOT testers? What I really found interesting about this is just the evolution. So what began as a fairly sort of rudimentary test of just checking the brakes and the lights and the steerings, and how it evolved. And again, the author behind this piece, Andrew Roberts, has done an absolutely fantastic job of raiding archives for what period Motoring Magazine said of the MOT test at the time. Just really interesting to sort of see about that initial skepticism, the necessity of its requirements, almost a view that it was just a tax on motorists. It wasn't seen as being something that was to benefit safety. It was a way of netting more money for the government from motorists, sort of thing. I don't think that's a sentiment that's ever really gone away, has it? So, as I sort of said, we've got that look back and just the effect that the MOT had on the motoring world, high streets and driveways of car owners at that time, what cars it saw, you know, disappear, and just the effect that it had on manufacturers as well, and how they had to meet requirements and how that changed the style of cars that they built. Definitely worth a read. And we also had a word with some knowledgeable experts. In fact, it was James that was responsible for that particular feature. Just really, as I said, questioning the validity of the MOT for classic car enthusiasts today.
James, you can talk about it. Yeah.
No, we've got a bit of delay here. I think there's a bird on the telephone wire outside in Somerset.
But intercepting the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's always interesting, the subject of the MOT, isn't it? It's a hot potato. People either completely go with it and agree with it, or other people hate it because they hate being told what to do by somebody else. So where you stand on that one, who knows? But yeah, it's definitely worth a read, I would say.
Yeah, it's I love it when we get these sort of rich history pieces come through Classic Car Weekly, and especially when it's the Andrew Roberts pieces that sort of he does so well at encapsulating the history and sort of the context and colour of the scene that it's sort of set in. So it made for an absolutely fantastic read. Often sort of when I disappear off my lunch breaks, what I will do is actually sort of when something is mid-production is actually read it before it's even hit the page, just sort of the blank copy that's come through. It's I'm always eager to sort of see what goes on. And yeah, especially when it's an Andrew Roberts, the way we were on Andrew Roberts feature, it always just sort of captures the imagination of it so brilliantly. I always look forward to it, and I think he's done a sterling job with this one. I think that the reader will really enjoy it when it lands on shop shelves and doormats today. Essentially, we're recording this for
once. It's the relatability. It's that idea that people have not changed. Their opinions, their views are all sort of very similar to the ones that we hold today, despite technological advancements, despite cars being fundamentally different. The way that we view our relationship with them, it's really surprising how that doesn't seem to have changed in 60 years. So
yeah, 6.5 decades later, we're still sort of encountering the same arguments and viewpoints from the British motorist, and the same sort of dissonance between that and the powers that be that authenticate the MOT. It's an interesting one. It's nice to see that we haven't changed in that aspect. Elsewhere in the issue, it's another busy one. We've got a second feature that looks back at the Jaguar SS at 90 years, which is lovely sort of touring sports car. Our Classics sees finally the story of me ragging a Suzuki Jimny around Corfu make it to page. And we've also got the usual sort of plethora of auction reports the way we were as well, which heads off to Marlborough down in the New Forest, which is lovely. Gents, we've got anything else to add at the end of this week's issue? Otherwise we'll crack on, because we're on a bumper issue this week before we head to the revival.
No, just that obviously next issue on sale September 17th is a special issue. Upsize pagination, obviously it'll carry our full coverage from the Goodwood Revival, and there's some really interesting complementary features that relate to some of those elements that are going to be at this year's Revival, so definitely worth looking out for that next Wednesday.
Plenty tucked into it. Otherwise, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I'll let you all get back to production, as we've got plenty ahead of us. Chris, James, thank you.
Thank you very much. No worries.
And we'll be back with another edition of Classic Car Weekly and the Classic Car Weekly podcast.